BadQuaker.com podcast. With me today is Max Abramson, and he's got a very unique story to tell. This is coming to us from New Hampshire. I've got in front of me the public notice on the case that you're involved in, but I'm not tilt the audience is listening by reading it first. I'm going to just let you jump right in and tell your story.
Okay. If I might start off, I wish I could say it's an unusual case, but I've been talking with gun owners and gun rights activists for the last, you know, few years, and unfortunately this case is fairly common. Prosecutors like to go after gun owners, and they like to go after people who act in self-defense. The man up in Farmington who fired a round into the ground to stop a burglar from getting away originally was also prosecuted for reckless conduct with a firearm. And he would have gotten a felony, and he would have gotten 6 years in prison himself, except that the attorney that he hired was very quick to go into public relations mode and address the media and the public very quickly. Statewide found out about that, and the prosecutor, under public pressure, was forced to drop the charges. But a lot of prosecutors in this country like to go after people who act in self-defense. What happened in my case was my housemate allowed a friend of his to throw a party in my house without my permission, and I actually forbade it when I first heard about it. And they set it up downstairs the day of, about 5 or 6 p.m., and were moving everything around, and I told them that I had specifically forbade the party, and they just went ahead and did it anyway, saying that they already had people on the way, and they were coming in from great distances, so foolishly, I allowed them to just go ahead and do it because I figured I was upset with my housemate and his friend Lee and Kevin, but I really couldn't hold it against the people who thought that they were coming to a party that had been approved by the homeowner. But people started showing up through the evening, and everything was fine for a while until probably about 1 in the morning. I really had gotten tired of it, and I'd finally said, you know, you people have been here long enough. You know, it's getting late. You need to go home.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have to go home, but you can't stay here. You try to be polite about it at first, and for probably an hour, I thought I was being very reasonable.
Right.
And about 1:30, 2 a.m., it's at the point where I'm just frustrated, and I need to get to sleep. I was really tired at that point. And about 2:20 in the morning, I'm sitting there arguing with this guy, actually Kevin, who it's basically his party. In fact, he set it up and invited a lot of people who we didn't even want and didn't know, and neither of us knew. And then some of those people then invited these other people who nobody knew, who turned out to be criminals, but we didn't know that at the time.
Mm-hmm.
So about 2:20 in the morning, I'm sitting there arguing with this guy, saying, you've got to go home. His cousin is there arguing with him. He's got to go home. He insists on spending the night. I said, dude, you don't have permission to spend the night here. So he runs upstairs about 2:38 in the morning, and I'm livid at this point. And I was not screaming at anyone, but I'm pretty upset. Run upstairs. Another man named Malcolm is also sleeping upstairs, also without my permission. I've told everyone to go home. I'd made the rounds a couple of times. And while I'm looking for Kevin, I hear sounds like boxes collapsing downstairs, and somebody yells as I come back to the main level. Somebody yells from downstairs where the party's going on. They say, Max, get down here. So I run down, and there's a like a football pile of people down on the bottom of the stairs near the stairwell, and I'm trying to figure out how people could end up falling all over each other. And one of the people who gets up, his face is bleeding really badly. Hmm. And I thought, well, somebody's been hurt. I might have to call an ambulance for this. And the last of the people get up, and as soon as the last of those people get up, it's out of control. I've seen a lot of fights in my life, but this just got out of control instantly. And the thoughts of calling ambulance were quickly replaced with thoughts of maybe having to call the state patrol and have people come in and have people arrested. But I didn't have an opportunity to call the police because I didn't have my phone on me. I didn't have access to the phone, and I couldn't remember where I'd left my cell phone.
Now, are you, let me interrupt you for a second, are you within a city limits there, or is this out in the county?
It's in a town called Seabrook. We do have a town police department, but they're not the kind of police you want to call in an emergency.
Mm-hmm.
There's no polite way of putting it. They're maybe the most corrupt police department in the state.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to reserve that by saying there are a handful of good cops on the Seabrook Police Department. But overall, I'd say we've got at least a dozen who are dishonest, out of control. You don't want these kind of people in your house.
Right.
I would say that they're just...
They would add to the problem, not solve it.
Right. And in fact, later on when they did arrive, it took them a long, long time to get there after somebody did call the police. They escalated the situation and made things worse.
Mm-hmm.
So...
Okay, so we're back at the pile has opened up, and now the brawl has started, so to speak.
So I dive in. Lee tried to dive in, but he's a really small, skinny guy. He's tall, but he's amazingly thin and amazingly lightweight, and he can get thrown around pretty easily. So he tries to dive in, and he's frantic. Another young guy named Jeremy tried to get in and pull people off of each other. Kevin eventually comes downstairs, and I believe he was trying to pull people off. But other than that, you had several people involved in this brawl, and they're shoving each other and hitting each other and smacking each other. And I jump and punching really, really hard. Everything's moving really fast, so I dive in between. There's actually a woman there named Jessica. She's this big, big woman, probably the biggest person in the event. And she goes ballistic, and she dives in and tries to protect her brother, who's actually a little bit smaller than she is. And she's going after this big guy named Paris Cormier, who I did not know before this, but I found out quite a bit about him afterwards. He's a gang leader with a long, long criminal background.
Mm-hmm.
A couple of counts of attempted murder and several assault and battery convictions and that kind of thing. So trying to get involved in this and trying to stop people from fighting, Jeremy grabs my arm hard, really hard, and yanks me over to the base of the stairwell. And standing there is a woman holding a steak knife straight up, not straight up, but maybe at a 70-degree angle, close to straight up. And I see she's got the steak knife, and then I see she's got a beer bottle on the other hand turned up, and I, you know, things are moving really fast,
mm-hmm.
and the fight's still going on behind me and can't hear anything.
Yeah.
And she says something. She's kind of a quiet person, but she has a psychotic look on her face, and she said, "I'm going to kill whoever's messing with my boyfriend."
Wow.
So that's kind of, I'm still looking at that beer bottle thinking, what would someone want to do with that? And so I quickly reached out, grabbed the steak knife, and yanked it out of her hand. And when I yanked it so hard, my pinky was on one of the serrations of the steak knife. Ooh. And cut into my pinky.
Wow.
And so that's bleeding. And as soon as I get it out, I notice that out of her hand, I notice that the steak knife is pointing in a kind of a dangerous orientation. So I'm thinking, is it better pointing down or pointing up? You know, there's no safe way to handle a steak knife.
Mm-hmm.
Jeremy grabs the knife and takes it and hides it behind the TV. She's still got the bottle, and I'm still trying to figure out why someone would want an upside-down beer bottle.
Mm-hmm.
Everything kind of moves in slow motion when you've got the adrenaline going, and she takes the beer bottle and brings it up, again, to about a 70-degree angle, and she starts shaking it a little bit. And when it's moving in slow motion, everything looks like kind of a slow dance.
Right.
And then I realize what her intention is. Now she's holding it like a weapon. So with my left hand, I reach out and grab it real quick and yank really hard and yank it out of her hands. Use the brute force approach and just yanked it out and try to find a place to hide the bottle, stash the bottle where people aren't going to grab it. So I stash it in the corner, and I start yelling for people to stop fighting, get out, get the F out, get the F out of my house. And they won't do it. They're, you know, one or two people who look like they have any inkling now of getting out. Everyone else is involved in the fight, either shoving and pushing and punching each other, or they're getting involved trying to pull people off of each other.
Now, just to be clear, at this point, it has the potential of being a life and death situation. You've already had someone clearly threatening at that point, so it's definitely a life or death situation then.
Well, no question about it. This is at 2:38 in the morning when the fight breaks out. Probably by 2:40, it's already life and death. There's no question the intent is there, and Paris was absolutely out of control. He was like an animal attacking this other guy, attacking Bobby.
Mm-hmm.
And it was like, you know, just seeing how hard he was hitting him and how fast he was moving, I just kept thinking, wow, I'd hate to imagine what would happen if he had a bottle or a knife. And I instantly think, there are beer bottles all over the place.
Yeah.
There's glass all over the place in this basement. There are weapons everywhere, potential weapons everywhere. And Amanda has just run back upstairs to grab something else, probably another knife. And I'm thinking, you know, you've got steak knives upstairs, I've got kitchen knives upstairs. You know, there are all kinds of potential weapons around the house. The jury heard most of that. They didn't hear, in my case, that this blonde woman came back down the stairs with a hatchet, chasing after Lee, screaming at him, threatening to kill him for calling the police.
Now, let me interrupt again. If I recall the story, they actually wouldn't allow you to bring that into the case, right?
That's correct. And that's validation. It's not called validation, but in a life and death situation, when you act, for example, when you shoot a gun at someone or in the ground or do anything like that, they don't allow you to bring up anything that happens after that as proof of self-defense.
Yeah.
Even though that the things that happen right afterwards
mm-hmm.
are very, very important to validate the fact that you were acting in self-defense.
Right.
Because there's no way that you can prove what the look on someone's face is or how people are moving. People just forget that.
Right.
The witnesses don't describe the look on people's faces because that's not what they're thinking about.
Mm-hmm.
What people remember is, you know, the attack and what happened afterwards and what it looked like someone was doing and who was moving at whom, and that's not very good for court testimony. So I explained the details as well as I... Well, let me jump back to the fight.
Okay.
I look at the situation, and in about a second I realize, you know, it's do something right now or somebody's going to get killed.
Right. It is life or death.
Right. Oh, no question about it. There's blood all over the floor. I can't tell how many people are bleeding. One guy jumped in my face and yelled, "Look at my face, look what he did to my effing face," and he's spitting blood in my face. So now I wipe my hand against my face, and there's blood on my hand.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm wondering, how many people are bleeding right now? How many people are injured right now? And how many people are going to be injured and bleeding if I don't do anything?
Right.
So I run to the sliding glass door and slam it open. That was kind of my plan A, which I didn't think was going to work. Plan B is pull the gun out. Plan C is shoot the gun in the ground because there's nobody out there.
Mm-hmm.
Plan C was basically, you know, shoot Paris before he kills somebody. And
I did. Let me interrupt real quick. It might have even been a justified killing had you shot him.
Oh, no question. I was justified probably in killing two or three people under the law.
Yeah.
Just for the people who are attacking me with weapons.
Right.
So I run over, grab the sliding glass door, slid it open as loud as I could, and it's quiet. It makes a quiet thud.
Mm-hmm.
And I showed that during the jury view, during the trial. That was the first thing we did on the first day. Slid the door open as hard as I could, and people could barely hear it. So I slide the sliding glass door open as hard as I can. didn't work. Looked around. No one's paying attention. They're still involved in the fight. So I pull my weapon out of my holster. I've got my constable badge on my belt, and I've got my holster right next to it. Because I'm an elected I was an elected peace officer in town, which is not the same as a member of the Seabrook Police Department. It's an honorary unpaid position.
Right.
But you get elected to it. Drew the weapon out of my holster. 95% of the time I don't keep a round in the chamber. What I do is, just in case somebody ever grabs my gun, just to buy me that extra second, I make sure that the chamber is empty. And I keep the weapon, when I go out and about, I have the weapon on me at all times. When I'm indoors, I usually just stash it in the gun safe. Unfortunately, in this case, the gun safe was downstairs, and there was no opportunity to, you know, to put it away.
Right.
So I had the weapon on me, drew it out, pulled the slide back to load around into the chamber, and I look around and see, you know, that's plan B. Maybe people will see that I've got the gun and I'm willing to use it and they'll stop.
Right.
Had absolutely no effect. They completely ignored it. Well, a .40 caliber Glock is one of the loudest handguns there is.
Mm-hmm.
It's 156 decibels. It's as loud as a shotgun. It's as loud as a cannon.
Yeah.
Other than the Magnum Force weapons, it's probably the loudest handgun there is. So I take it, I sight the weapon up into the ground, pull the weapon back in a little bit to put the end of the barrel just inside the house.
To get the
sound.
At the
threshold. And I'm pointing the weapon at the ground outside, and I do a quick head check, right and then left, and then re-sight the weapon. When I looked left, I noticed only one person, Jessica, was looking at me from the side, and she had this kind of quizzical look on her face, like, really? Really? You have a gun? It was shocking. It's like they're all, you know, I didn't know she was from Massachusetts, but that's kind of the attitude they have. A homeowner with a gun? Really? So I see that, and it's one of the things that sticks out in my mind. And the last thought before I fired the gun into the ground was, welcome to New Hampshire, sweetie. Boom! I fired the round right into the ground. It's well lit. All the outside lights are on. Inside lights are on. It's the full moon out. You can plainly see exactly where the round went. And people hear that shock, and it echoes around the room a couple of times. And some people said one, two, three shots. Jessica actually said four shots. Her story changed all over the place. It's kind of kind of difficult to.
That's actually kind of,
but
that's kind of a frequent thing when there's a gunshot that witnesses don't know how many times they heard the gunshot.
Well, but at least they remember how many hands are on the gun. I can't one hand a 40.
Right.
I two hand it. I sight it. I don't think I've ever fired a handgun outside of a gun range in my life. You know, it's like an insurance policy. As long as it just sits there in your holster, it keeps you safe. Statistically, it keeps you safer, and you never think you're going to have to use it. In this case, I did have to use it, and that was a really difficult experience because it was life and death, and you have to come up with a solution right then and right there.
Right.
Fired the round into the ground in the backyard after checking to make sure it was completely clear. I did the head check to make sure I had 180 degrees of safety, just as you'd hope to have under ideal circumstances, which you usually don't. Fired the weapon in a safe direction, and finally the fighting stops. Everything stops for just a second. Everything completely stops, and finally everyone is looking at me in the room. I look over to the left where the various people are fighting, and they're just standing there. And one of them, Paris, says something I'll never forget. He says, he takes a step towards me and he stops, and he says, "Go ahead and shoot me." He wants to be man enough. He says, "Go ahead and shoot me. Those are blanks anyway. I know what blanks sound like." And then he charges at me, and he reaches at me, comes across the front of me, grabs my forearm with one hand to try to hold my hand in place. But I pull my body around, and his other hand reaches across to try to grab my gun, and I keep it from him. Malcolm, who'd been sleeping upstairs, is actually taller than Paris and a big husky guy, grabs Paris and tries to stop him. Everyone kind of came straight for me. Everyone came straight for me except for Jessica, who decided to just go upstairs and take off. So Paris tries to grab me. He's got his hand on my arm, and I took my forearm, and I twisted it around. I used a move I learned from Taekwondo.
Mm-hmm.
Twisted it around like a wrench and ripped it right out of his hand. He has a really incredible grip. He's a really dangerous guy, and you'd have to see him in person in an actual fight to see what kind of person this is. It's like watching a wild animal in a fight.
Yeah.
And when I finally got his criminal records a few months later, it was actually about a year later. It was no surprise to see all the different violent criminal convictions that he had, and all the breaking and entering, 2 counts of attempted murder, drug trafficking, reckless endangerment, DUIs, all that kind of thing. He'd been in and out of prison over and over and over again his whole life, adult life. So that was the end of that. Pulled my arm, out of his hand and took the weapon and immediately reholstered it. At that point, somebody got into Paris's space and said, "Hey, we need to get out of here. He's got a gun, yada, yada, yada. It's New Hampshire."
Mm-hmm.
So people start filing out, but the two guys, John and Jeremy, who had gotten a ride to the party from Lee's vehicle had broken down. He'd taken it out in the woods off-roading, four-wheel driving, and wrecked his exhaust, pulled the exhaust right off the bottom of his truck. So they didn't have a ride. So very quickly, and no one has called 911 at this point. Lee gets in my face, and he says something about calling the police. He's got the Seabrook police on there on his fast dial, and I'm thinking, you know, if you got the Seabrook police, why don't you just call the State Patrol?
Yeah.
You know, the State Patrol in New Hampshire has some very professional troopers who are actually trained to deal with situations like this.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I have no problem calling them. In fact, I have their number. It's 800-525-5555. Got it committed to memory now. So
yeah.
That's the number to call if you're in New Hampshire and you've got a bad police department. You need somebody there who's professional.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't have that in my phone at the time, and I didn't have their number at the time. Actually, I didn't have my phone on me at that time. So people are finally leaving, and I'm thinking, I'm so glad it's all over. Everyone's taking off except for John and Jeremy, and everyone else is going upstairs, or they're going to their vehicles, or they're ready to take off. And I said to myself, it's finally all over.
Right.
So I give John and Jeremy a ride home and drive away, and on the way out, the police pull us over. Long story short, they were, you know, typical Seabrook, out of control. Sergeant Bucheri was giving conflicting orders with another officer. They were both giving different orders, and trying to follow the different orders. Put your hands where you can see them. Put your hands on the steering wheel. Put your hands on the dash. Put your hands on the roof.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm moving my hands everywhere, and it's like doing the hokey pokey or something like that with these two different cops giving us different orders.
Right.
And finally, Bucheri gets pissed off. Sorry, I used bad language, but he slams the hood of my car with his flashlight. Sorry. And he's ticked off, and it's like you can plainly see he's got his light on my hands, and he says, "Get him up, put him on the roof." I'm like, "The roof or the headliner? What do you want? We're looking at this guy like he's from Mars or something. He's out in left field. He repaints the story in his police report that he was so professional and he was so on top of things, and he tried to paint me like some out of control drug dealer or something,
mm-hmm.
like I'm all drugged out of my mind or something.
And unfortunately, there's no dash camera or anything like that.
Oh, of course not. Not with Seabrook.
Mm-hmm.
Real quick background on this. I've been trying to get dash cams in the cruisers for, I don't know, probably as long as I've been in Seabrook. Dash cams are terrific. If I can advocate for a second, they cut your insurance rates. You're less likely to get sued as a town. They're great for gathering evidence. They're great for a training tool. The only people who don't like them are criminals and bad cops.
Right, exactly.
Most good cops, in fact, probably almost all good cops who know about bad cops on their department want dash cams in their cruisers,
mm-hmm.
and they advocate for them. Unfortunately, the faction in Seabrook, the Seabrook Police Union that's in control right now, does not want dash cams because they know what's going to be caught.
Right.
Excessive force and violence and taking payoffs from drug dealers. It's It's a small number of cops on the department. It's probably less than half.
Yeah.
On the Seabrook Police Department, who are like that. But
if you get even, no matter the size of the department, if you get even close to half of the cops that are bad, or some that are bad and at least half that are looking the other way, you've got a pretty dangerous thing there in a police force.
Well, and I explained that to the jury during the trial. I said, I'm sorry, you saw the cops come up and testify, and you saw them change their stories and mm-hmm. tell you that they knew what they said, and then they don't remember what they said and what I said, and they screwed up the investigation, and you could clearly see that. But I said there are a few good cops on the Seabrook Police Department. There are a lot of good cops in New Hampshire. There are a lot of very professional cops in New Hampshire who'd never lie on the stand or do what these officers did.
Right.
But I didn't want to give the appearance that I'm strictly anti-cop. I'm pro-police accountability. If you're going to put people out there with a badge and a gun, there needs to be some accountability there.
Right.
And the dash cams, I've been advocating in town for a long time, and they're very much against this. And they'd had some problems with reckless driving, abuse of power. If they had dash cams, it would catch them. They have been caught on video a few times screwing around in the back of the vehicle or screwing around on the hood of the vehicle with some woman they'd picked up, or the payoffs from drug dealers I've heard from a couple areas of town. And the main problem with the department is retaliation.
Yeah.
That there have been so many people who've come forward and spoken out and have faced retaliation, and usually they throw bogus charges at them. They don't carry out an investigation. They really screw things up. And people usually get acquitted, but once in a while, people facing retaliation get convicted, and that's unfortunately what happened to me at the trial. The jury heard most of what happened, and they saw a lot of what happened, but there were people in town who I asked to come forward and speak about the Seabrook police and what they told me, and I was not able to get that in because people were concerned about retaliation themselves.
And I should add, too,
that was probably the tipping point that they had the jury saying, well, how come he didn't bring witnesses in to say that?
Yeah. I should add, too, that even if you if this retaliation takes place, and even if you fight it and you win, and and it's thrown out on any case, not specifically yours, but any case, that still costs a lot of money. People don't like to have to cough up thousands of dollars to fight something that they're innocent of.
We had a selectman who went through the same thing, and he was not a supporter of their outrageous overtime budgets, and there was a conflict, and they, of course, filed charges against him.
Mm-hmm.
And this was a selectman in town, and he had to spend over $20,000 fighting it, and he still has cops come into his business and kind of do the little harassment thing.
Yeah.
And so this has been going on and on and on. The place where the police get their cruisers maintained or fixed.
Mm-hmm.
At that place, they had a couple of kids get pulled over. They had a couple of kids get pulled over for driving without a license, and one of them had, pot, something like that. And initially, they filed charges against them. And when they find out that these kids are associated with the garage where the cop cars get fixed, mm-hmm. all of a sudden the charges all get dropped.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's typical. In fact, one of the worst instances was a case where a woman who was a drunk driver hit another woman who was at the stop sign waiting to make a left turn. She was kind of rear-ended in such an obvious way that there's no question.
Mm-hmm.
There's no question whose fault it was.
Yeah.
And it turned out that the drunk driver was an ex-girlfriend of one of the cops. Mm-hmm. And so because of that, the woman who got hit ended up being named in the police report, even though it was physically impossible for her to kind of back up and sideswipe her car that way.
Yeah.
It was the drunk driver, the cop's ex-girlfriend, who had done it.
Amazing.
So, but I mentioned that to someone, and someone told me about a more recent incident where that happened again, almost the exact same incident, except it was a current girlfriend who got drunk and hit a car just a few weeks ago. And that cop is married, and so the cop doesn't, most of the cops are married, and most of the cops also have girlfriends.
Yeah.
So close on half of them are having affairs at any given point.
Now, in your case, are you awaiting, I can't think of the, where the judge decides what the punishment is going to be, or what state is your case in right now?
Well, the sentencing is going to happen in May, and when sentencing happens, you have to have your appeal ready to go right away. So I'm at the point where I've ordered the CD for the entire trial, and you have to go through every objection and every motion and find where you can file appeals on issues that are reversible. The problem is most of those issues are at the discretion of the court.
Mm-hmm.
This particular judge, I'll give a shout-out for this guy, William Delker, is actually a really, really top-notch judge. He's not infallible, but he's one of the best. He's one of the fairest, and he's also one of the most knowledgeable judges I've seen. And I'm not trying to butter him up for sentencing. He really is, you know, he really is one of the better judges sitting on the bench. He really knows. I mean, he knows it. He served under the Attorney General's office, and he knows under Kelly Ayotte, who's now a senator.
Mm-hmm.
And he knows exactly how much discretion a trial judge has. He knows all the ins and outs of the system. He knows the case law. He knows cases I've never even heard of. He knows cases from the 19th century. He knows the criminal code really, really well. And he knows exactly what a trial judge is allowed to do. And when he was a prosecutor, he was citing the cases and telling the trial judge what he's allowed to do. And he's gone in front of the state Supreme Court a few times, and he won most of his cases. In fact, he got to be so good as a prosecutor that they finally caved in and realized they had to make him a judge because,
mm-hmm.
you know, but that's another story. He really is top-notch. But he did make I felt he made a few mistakes on handling some of the indictments. And the one in particular that we're looking at is indictments list different elements, and they're required to list certain things. One of the things they have to list is the defendant, what he did, where he was, about what time that happened, and they have to prepare the defense for what they're going to have to kind of present as evidence, you know, the date, approximate time, in order to provide a defense. One of the things you have to provide is the name of the victim. And I was facing 8 felony indictments at one point.
Wow.
And we got rid of 3 of them at halftime, which means when you switch from the prosecution to the defense,
mm-hmm.
you make halftime motions. You make a whole series of halftime motions. And there were only 3 that they could really toss that had no evidence whatsoever. And so that left 5. Well, one of the ones that was left over was, you know, the one that we really, really thought, I had the assistance of standby counsel, we really thought was going to be tossed out. And the prosecution made a mistake that a first-year law student wouldn't make, and that was she failed to put a name on that indictment. Instead, she just put another and then sent it off. And that's one that comes up at trial, and you toss it. It's a defective indictment.
Yeah, right.
And it changes the effect of the charge, and, you know, you can't defend against it, and it's too vague, and those things usually get thrown out. The problem is that the judge, although he caught pretty much everything at the trial at one point, he seems to have missed that one.
So that
and
might be a point
the effect
that
of that is, felony reckless conduct with a firearm literally means, if it's deadly force, you are shooting at someone else.
Yeah.
And that victim has to be named. When they changed it, when they took one of those indictments and put another in there, it changed the effect of it. It changed what the statute meant. And you can't do that with an indictment.
Mm-hmm.
Just putting the word another in there and then selling it to the jury on the argument that, hey, you're firing at the ground, yes, but there could have been someone who walked by.
Mm.
That's not felony reckless conduct with a firearm. That's, at worst, it could be misdemeanor reckless conduct, which is a much lower charge, and it might even be unauthorized use of firearms. Nevertheless, the jury had been noticed and the prosecution had been noticed by us of defenses. In fact, we listed 4 defenses. The main one, of course, was defense of others. And they heard nothing but evidence from day one until closing. Defense of others, knives, the weapons, the bottles, the potential weapons that are around,
mm-hmm.
severity of the fight. Even the prosecution's witnesses, even the police photos, which were some very sloppy photos taken with the $34 digital camera that, you know, parents give to their kids for Christmas as a toy.
Yeah.
Not even a professional quality, crime scene quality camera. All of the evidence showed overwhelmingly the same thing that the defense had been saying over and over again, that I fired a round into the backyard, which I told the jury on opening, I fired a round into the backyard to break up a fight and prevent people from getting hurt.
Right.
And I explained everything to the jury, and the whole trial, of course, when you tell the truth, the whole trial, for the most part, played right into what they call the defense theory, which, having told them the truth, I pretty well expected that to happen. But by the end of the case, the prosecutor kept twisting and twisting and twisting everything around. She twisted facts and details around, twisted around what the witnesses had said, cherry-picked certain words and sentences and answers from different witnesses, and repainted the whole thing to say that I was drunk, which I wasn't. I'd had three beers in the evening and then nothing after 11, so I was completely sober by midnight anyway. And she said it's completely dark out, even though the jury had been judicially noticed of the full moon and all the lights on, and even though the police photos show them arriving on the scene with all the lights out on inside the house and outside,
mm-hmm.
and then it shows them in another photo about 30 seconds later, they turned the light out and then took one picture of the outside with the light turned off to try to make it look darker.
Mm.
And because it's a cheap camera, looking outside with the photo taken from inside with a flash,
mm-hmm.
it's a cheap camera, has a 15-foot flash range.
Right.
The effect was it made it look like it was really dark outside, like it was pitch black. And it wasn't pitch black. It was as well lit as it's ever been at night. Full moon and everything. All the lights are on, everything.
How would you like to support BadQuaker.com and get something nice for yourself at the same time? I want to tell you about Survival Gear Bags. It's run by my friend Kelly, who believes in and adheres to the non-aggression principle. Kelly's customers know him for his great customer service and his personal touch, because Kelly handles all customer service himself. The main focus of Survival Gear Bags is to allow you to build your own custom emergency kits with quality gear. Now, I know this because I bought my bug out bag from Survival Gear Bags over 2 years ago, and I've gone all over the country with it by my side. And you can rest assured that the prices will always be the best they can be at Survival Gear Bags. And if you use the link from BadQuaker.com, they'll probably throw in something for free for you with your order. Now, how do you do this? Well, it's simple. You go to BadQuaker.com. On the right side of the page, click on the picture of the backpack. Then look around at Survival Gear Bags and find the stuff you want. You'll help BadQuaker.com, and you'll support a merchant that's one of us. Now, I want to tell you about another way you can support BadQuaker.com and get something really cool at the same time. Shire Silver. Shire Silver is the proud seller of silver and gold trade cards. Shire Silver believes that silver and gold trade cards will show the world a better way to save, spend, and share precious metals. So what are silver and gold trade cards? There are specific weights of gold and silver laminated inside credit card-sized tradable cards. They're a handy and affordable way to trade precious metals. These cards received nationwide recognition when they were widely used as barter at the New Hampshire Porcupine Festival. You want a beer and a hot dog? Hand them a Shire Silver 5 card and get a Shire Silver 1 spot back as change. So again, what do you do? Well, you go to BadQuaker.com. On the right side, just below the backpack, you'll see the Shire Silver trade cards. Click on those cards and then check out Shire Silver's site. Be sure and watch Ron's video that's right there on the main page. And then swap some of those ridiculous Federal Reserve notes for something of real value. Something you can keep, trade, or give as the coolest gift ever. But be sure and use the link from BadQuaker.com. Thanks, folks.
So when I fired the weapon, there was no question about what I was shooting at. I took a well-aimed shot right at the ground. She tried to sell it as, well, another person might have been walking along, and he's firing one-handed from the side, one-handing a .40 caliber. And the testimony that she used came from one witness who said at one point that I was facing her and then facing the other way, and then 10 feet away, all the other witnesses said I was right at the threshold. This one witness said that I was 10 feet away at one point, one-handing it, shooting through the door. The same witness said that the door was closed, so I'd have to shoot through the glass. There's no broken glass. And she said, four shots. Then she said, well, maybe two or three, then one or two. And then, well, maybe it was one. There are no shell casings inside the house. There's one shell casing found outside the house, right next to the door.
Mm-hmm.
And they didn't even bother looking for the bullet, which you'd have to do for crime scene reconstruction.
Right.
So go through the whole trial, and the whole case, prosecution's whole case, completely falls apart. It was never substantiated because it was never true. And she, Conway, Patricia Conway, who goes after gun owners all the time, at the end of the case, in closing, she takes cherry-picks all these little inconsistencies everywhere in her own case and pulls them out and repeats them over and over and over again on closing. He didn't call the police, which I couldn't once the fight had started anyway. I didn't even have a phone on me.
Right.
Let alone being able to get access to a phone if I knew where it was, where the cell phone was. She cherry-picks all these little inconsistencies. The one witness who said that it was dark outside said that she could plainly see, insisted there was no one out there, meaning that it wasn't dark outside. There was enough light for her to see.
Right.
She knew for a fact that there was no one out there, and there could not have been anyone out there. And there are so many windows, and it's so clear, and it's so obvious that you can clearly see if there's someone out there or not. You mm-hmm. can hear if there's someone out there or not. And I fired at a spot in the ground where there's no way anyone could be standing there.
Yeah.
There's no way anyone could be standing in the way. And Conway argued that people were walking in and out all the time, having to smoke all the time, that there could be people sitting at the picnic table. Even with all the blood, broken glass, broken mugs, broken beer bottles, with my house being trashed, even with the blood all over the floor, she said it wasn't really a fight, that they were just bickering. I'm just sitting there. Listen to all these crazy crackpot theories. You could have a hiker coming around. There could have been a hiker out there in the woods when it was dark. And I just keep thinking, from where? Who goes for a hike at 3 o'clock in the morning into my backyard? It has never happened ever.
Amazing.
Let alone at 3 o'clock in the morning. I told the jury, I said, look, they have to prove all this. Look at all these different ways that the case falls apart, and it's not true, and it's, you know, one, it's not reckless conduct with a firearm, if you look at the definition of the statute.
Mm-hmm.
And secondly, I would be justified in doing that if I did fire in the direction of someone else because someone's about to get killed.
Yeah.
Self-defense, defense of others, defense of premises, you know, competing harms. And they heard all of this, and, you know, her case had fallen apart so badly because her own witnesses were going sideways, meaning that they would... She called people in to say certain things, and unfortunately, they all told the truth.
Mm.
They all had pressure on them to say, you know, testify for the prosecution.
Yeah.
They all fell apart, and yet somehow the jury believed the prosecutor when she made all this stuff up at the end.
Juries can be amazingly dumb.
Well, I objected several times when she was mischaracterizing evidence, misleading, misrepresenting the statute. And finally, the jury threw out four of the remaining indictments, but they convicted me on one, the one that said another as the victim. But another doesn't stand up in court as a victim because you have to name a witness.
Yeah.
And for all kinds of technical legal reasons, that it is unlikely to hold up, but it's just the principle that now gun owners everywhere in New Hampshire, and especially in Rockingham County, know that if you take action, if you use your gun to prevent a fight, to prevent people from getting hurt or killed, and especially in a situation that's as obvious as this, if there's even a chance that you could go to jail or get a felony conviction, people are going to think about that, and they're just going to, if they see a fight, they're not going to fire around into the ground.
Mm-hmm.
They're not going to do anything. They're not going to fire around into the air. One of the most important deterrents to crime is the fear that criminals have that they're going to run into someone who's armed.
Right.
And you take that away, and all of a sudden it's like New Jersey or New York or Maryland, where you've got these cities where the crime's out of control, in Chicago and
right,
Washington, D.C.,
yeah.
because everyone's been disarmed and no one can stop a criminal.
Yeah.
So it's, I explained to the jury, you've got 83 million gun owners who we know of mm-hmm. stopping over 2 million crimes in this country every year, and this is how we do it.
Yeah.
And they heard it all, but when the prosecutor came in and twisted everything around and kept repeating and repeating and repeating the same ridiculous things, the jury went in, and some of them were clearly against me, and some of them were clearly supporters of self-defense. But after about 5 hours of kind of haggling and deliberating and looking at all the photos all over again, and they finally came back and said, well, you know, guilty, presumably. He could have called the police, but instead he fired a round into the wilderness that could have hit someone.
Amazing.
So it's definitely appealable, but just the principle that a jury, not just a judge, but a jury, would convict someone who so clearly had acted as carefully and as responsibly as possible under the circumstances with a very limited amount of time.
Yeah.
That's going to have a chilling effect on gun owners, and it's going to have the opposite effect on inmates, on all the criminals out there.
Yeah.
Vast majority of criminals are not behind bars. Vast majority of criminals are out on the street right now.
Yeah, exactly.
And especially violent criminals and intruders. The people who are hardest to catch, or the police just don't want to catch or are unable to catch, or who've gotten, you know, like Paris Cormier, who've gotten sweetheart deal after sweetheart deal after sweetheart deal.
Yeah, they know how to play the system. They work the system.
Oh, no question. When they're committing their crimes, they already have plea deals in mind.
Yeah.
They already know what to do to get rid of evidence. They already know, you know, a lot of them have a public defender who they know.
Right.
A lot of them have an attorney on retainer. A lot of the drug dealers have an attorney on retainer.
Mm-hmm.
They already know to say nothing to the cops.
Yeah.
They already know. They only associate with people who won't talk to the cops.
Mm-hmm.
And they kind of, you know, they work the system. They've been on the stand before. They've been to court before. They know what to wear, and they know how to game the system.
Oftentimes,
they work the system of plea deals to get 4 months or 6 months for rape or attempted murder or car theft or burglary, and
right.
And you know, they know when they've been got, and when they've been got, they avoid trial by taking the plea bargain. So they're committing hundreds and hundreds of crimes against people and stealing whatever they can.
Oftentimes, criminals like that actually know the law better than the police and better than a lot of prosecutors and defense attorneys and even judges, because they've been through it so much. And when they're actually in prison, they have the perfect opportunity to learn everything that they did wrong. They can go over it and over it and over it until they just perfect their system.
Oh, there's no question. What's amazing to me is that some of these professional criminals, they get so much experience with the system that they become lawyers.
Yeah.
They have correspondence courses for inmates, and if you've got 7 years in prison, you come out after 7 years, you've got your law degree.
Yeah.
You come out, you take the bar exam, and you specialize in a lot of attorneys are convicts.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of them are felons. And there's nothing to keep them out, and they had nothing else to do, and there's no other profession they can go into, so they go into law. And they fit right in. And I'm not trying to badmouth the criminals out there, but, you know, to go into a practice like that,
yeah,
that's really despicable, I think.
That's downgrading from being a criminal.
I hate drug dealers. I hate rapists. I hate people like that, but to see lawyers prosecuting innocent people, prosecuting people they know to be innocent, everyone has to have a defense attorney. There's going to be someone defending everyone, even Michael Addison, who shot Officer Michael Briggs and got the death penalty for it. Actually, this judge, when he was working in the Attorney General's office, was the main arguer, the main prosecutor who got Michael Addison, because he's the one who prosecuted Michael Addison in Manchester when they shot Michael Briggs. He was convicted, and they appealed. They have an automatic appeal process in New Hampshire, but very, very rarely do you win on appeal.
Mm-hmm.
And Delker prosecuted Addison, And the reason they chose Delker is he dots all his I's and crosses his T's, and he doesn't lose anyone on technicalities.
Yeah.
He does everything right. He knows exactly what a prosecutor can and cannot do, and he knows exactly what a trial judge can or cannot do.
Mm-hmm.
And he makes very, very few mistakes. And he's a very, very intelligent guy. I don't think anyone who's ever been through his court can complain about the process or treatment or unfairness. Although, you know, every judge is going to make, you have to make judgment calls on objections, and everyone's going to make mistakes here and there. But he's definitely one of the better judges I've seen in trials, and I've seen a lot of trials over the years. But getting back to this, the jury was not allowed to hear about all the attempted murder convictions. They weren't allowed to hear about all the breaking and entering and larceny and statutory rape and disorderly conduct. And,
mm-hmm.
you know, it was amazing. Page after page after page after page of violent crime convictions. And none of it got in.
Wow.
Because it might prejudice the jury.
Yeah, prejudice the jury to find out what a slug this guy really was and how much he should have been popped, maybe.
Well, I mean, in hindsight, having read about some of the things that he's done to people, there was one brief moment where he's charging at me trying to grab the gun.
Yeah.
Where I had a legitimate opportunity, and in retrospect, in hindsight,
mm-hmm.
it was stupid not to shoot the gun. Because he could have grabbed the gun and killed who knows how many people.
Yeah, yeah.
And
but you were trying to be the nice guy and do the right thing.
Yeah, well, don't try to be the nice guy. In hindsight, looking back on all of this, looking back how the law has kind of been twisted around and misused and misapplied, and
yeah.
and seeing the police lie on the stand like that, two of them, Hersey and Bukeri, just purposefully lied on the stand.
Hmm.
Hersey in particular completely fell apart. Absolutely, people were laughing at him when I was questioning on cross-examination.
Yeah.
Absolutely fell apart.
Hmm.
But in retrospect, having been through that whole process and then getting convicted
yeah.
and facing a felony conviction, at this point, I think I would have, if I could go back in time and do it all over again, I would just stand there and let people stab each other to death. Or you know what, I would have walked up the sliding glass door, and even though it was below freezing, I would just stand out there and wait until all the fighting stopped, and whoever gets stabbed, and I don't know most of these people, and
yeah.
bad for them. At this point, I think that most people would look at prosecution of people who are just trying to do the right thing and say, you know, I don't want to risk going to prison for 6 years or 30 years or 48 years at one point.
Yeah.
I don't want to risk going to prison for any amount of time to save people I don't know. So who knows, there could be a fight going on somewhere and there could be a gun owner standing there thinking, you know, I could fire a round into the ground and put a stop to this before somebody gets killed, and they're not going to do it.
Now, what is, you're facing the possibility of what, 6 years right now?
It's only 6 years. Usually first-time offenders don't get 6 years. About 50% of the time they get some prison time, some mm-hmm. jail time, but it's a possibility. It's something I'm going to be fighting against, but it's just the possibility, just the potential for it. Living in Rockingham County, where the juries aren't so good on self-defense,
yeah,
and having prosecutors, the Rockingham County Attorney's Office, who is very aggressive at going after gun owners,
mm-hmm.
Knowingly goes after gun owners. Rockingham County Attorney's Office is known for prosecuting people they know to be innocent.
Yeah.
I've actually started writing a book called Prosecuting the Innocent, and part of it's about the trial, and part of it's about Innocence Project and what they're working on, and a big part of it is, you know, going up to Concord and trying to promote certain reforms and improvements to our criminal justice system, and
uh-huh.
some of the problems with forensics. That's going to turn into an e-book probably in April or May. It's about halfway done right now, and the main issue is that you have this bureaucratic process where the prosecutor can choose to go after someone they know to be innocent. The judge can't do anything about it. Defense attorney can't do anything about it. The bailiffs can't do anything about it.
Mm-hmm.
And the jury can't find out about that fact.
Right.
And so you go on to jury duty, and you have no way of realizing that the prosecutor is withholding and keeping out evidence of innocence.
Yeah.
and that they're knowingly prosecuting someone who they know to be innocent.
Mm-hmm.
And Innocence Project estimated they've exonerated their 289th person a couple of weeks ago.
Wow.
Those people have served an average of 13 years in prison for crimes that they didn't commit.
Wow.
They'd asserted their innocence for years, and DNA testing in close to 60% of the cases showed that they were telling the truth. They've been innocent all along.
Well, hopefully someone will hear this podcast and will hear your story, and hopefully the story will get out enough to where maybe, you know, enough people in New Hampshire will hear this and can maybe help you out with this. I know specifically I'll call out one person by name that I'm going to try to get this podcast into their hands, and that's Bill Anderson. He was one of the guys that spearheaded in the Duke University rape case. He was one of the guys that attempted to get justice done in that and show that the prosecutor was openly and knowingly lying and falsifying information. So I'm going to do everything I can to get this podcast into his hands. And we definitely want to get as many people hearing the story as possible.
Now, I've called into Free Talk Live. This story has been front page for the last 2 weeks. The public has been hearing about some of what's gone on. What's amazing is that so many witnesses finally did come forward at the end of the trial and told the jury the truth about what really happened.
Mm-hmm.
And that it was so public and it was so obvious during the course of the trial that the prosecutor never had a case from day one. And it was only the last, you know, just literally the last 20 minutes of the trial where she's, you know, we come back on Monday and she's arguing and twisting and lying and misrepresenting things and deliberately kept evidence out and deliberately kept things out and having basically been at the bottom of the whole case. The evidence showed that I was innocent, and yet in her closing arguments, she was able to kind of manipulate things and repeat certain things over and over again to try to make it look like, hey, he fired around out into the darkness,
mm-hmm.
which she knew was not true.
Yeah.
And they had no evidence of that, and that somebody could have been walking out there, even though all of the witnesses said, no, that's not what happened. And she argued that, well, I could have called the police, and yet I had no opportunity to call 911 during the fight.
Right.
And there was no warning. It was just instant. It was out of control. And it was literally life and death, and someone had to do something. It was really a difficult situation. It was a difficult decision knowing that you're risking prosecution and risking jail time, prison time, in order to basically fire a shot and, you know, put a stop to the fight and prevent someone from getting stabbed.
Well, Max, I want to thank you for coming on the podcast with me, and I want to wish you the best of luck in all this, and I really hope everything goes well for you. I hope you get the appeal, and I hope you get a decent jury the next time. But thank you anyway for coming on the show, and we'll do everything we can to try to get as many people hearing about this as possible.
Yeah, thanks a lot.
To get in touch with Max on this, email ben@badquaker.com and put in the subject line Max, just the word Max. And any encouragement you have for Max, or the other thing you can do is go to badquaker.com to the page where this podcast is listed, and right at the bottom of that page you can enter your comments. And any words of encouragement you have for Max, or anything else that you can do to help, you can either email me, ben@badquaker.com, or go right to the website, go to the page where the podcast is located on, and go right to the bottom of that page and just fill in your comments right there. And as always, for more on liberty, the zero aggression principle, and property rights, go to badquaker.com. And thank you very much for listening.